Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Today, we conclude our Trust in AI series with this conversation with Catherine Hume, Vice President of Strategy at Integrate AI. You might remember Catherine from our interview last year on selling AI to the enterprise, which was Twimmel Talk number 20. This time around, we discuss her newly released white paper, Responsible AI in the Consumer Enterprise, which details a framework for ethical AI deployment in e-commerce companies and other consumer-facing enterprises. We look at the structure of the ethical framework she proposes and some of the many questions that need to be considered when deploying AI in an ethical manner. Thanks once again to Georgian Partners for their continued support of the podcast and for sponsoring this series. Georgian Partners is a venture capital firm that invests in growth stage business software companies that use applied artificial intelligence, conversational AI, and trust to differentiate and advance their business solutions. Post-investment, Georgian works closely with portfolio companies to accelerate the adoption of these key technologies for increased value. To help their portfolio companies hire the right technical talent, Georgian recently published Building Conversational AI Teams, a comprehensive guide to lead you through sourcing, acquiring, and nurturing a successful conversational AI team. Check it out at twimmelai.com/Georgian. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Catherine Hume. Catherine is the Vice President of Strategy with Integrate AI. Catherine, welcome back to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
It's wonderful to be here, Sam. One of my favorite podcasts.
Well, you are one of my most favorite people. So we are in the right place. And we are going to be talking about, broadly speaking, the topic of ethics and fairness and trust in AI. But before we do that, for those who haven't had a chance to listen to the wonderful podcast that we did a while back, I don't even remember when, but why don't you do a brief intro and then we'll refer people back to that previous show in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure. So as mentioned, right now I'm heading up strategy for a Toronto-based startup called Integrate AI. So we work with large consumer enterprises, so the retail banks and telcos and retailers of the world, and help them do a better job providing relevant experiences for their customers by applying machine learning into their customer engagement stacks. And prior to that, I worked at a New York City-based machine learning research lab called Fast Forward Labs. That's actually now part of Cloudera. That's where we last met. And, you know, during my time there, I was also working with the enterprise and sort of sitting between the world of academic research and the world of applied machine learning in the enterprise to help companies get a handle on what was actually ready for prime time as they tried to sort through the hype in the space and, you know, take them from the point of prototype conceptualization to actual scaled application. I guess the other thing to mention, and it is relevant for my background for this context, is that I have a doctorate in comparative literature and an undergrad in theoretical mathematics. And so I sort of bring a mixture of philosophy and epistemology, so the theories of knowledge, to my thinking around applied mathematics and machine learning. That's been a decent toolkit for my thinking about ethics.
And it's made for some very interesting conversations, I will say. So jumping into this conversation around ethics, you recently spearheaded the development of a white paper on what you called responsible AI in the consumer enterprise, which is a really interesting paper. What bucket do you put that in? Do you think of it as ethics or fairness or trust? There are a lot of words that we kind of throw around when thinking about some of the ethical issues with regards to AI as applied to the enterprise in particular. How do you kind of think through all that?
It's a great question. And there are so many terms being thrown around these days as basically we start to grapple with the implications of bringing machine learning algorithms from the research lab into the real world. And, you know, they sort of hit up against the surprising realities of human behavior and how human behavior gets reflected in data, and then how algorithms basically recycle some of these reflections and refractions into products that can have sometimes surprising results. So that's sort of I'd say a general statement. I'm sure there's lots to unpack there, but under that, this sort of general umbrella lies lots of terms that have social implications and technical implications, terms that you mentioned like responsibility, fairness, transparency, accuracy, bias. And I would say we in the paper cover all of those topics because we think they're all relevant and worth critical attention in the enterprise, as well as, you know, in society as a whole. But I'd say what we were trying to do and what's unique about this paper is we didn't design it as a policy paper. So it's not providing guidance to government agencies or regulators to help them think about holistically sort of how to define these concepts at a large level so we can agree upon what they mean in society. It's also not oriented specifically for a data science or machine learning practitioner audience where we would go into some of the latest and greatest research on, say, tackling fairness. This one is designed for cross-functional teams that work in consumer enterprises in particular. So it's aligned with some of the work we do at Integrate. And it's meant to operationalize ethics as a series of questions and dialogues that teams need to be asking and having at the various points in building out a machine learning product. So that was sort of the approach we take. We really wanted to go from the realm of philosophy to the realm of concrete, pragmatic, what do you need to be thinking about when? What are the questions? And how do you sort of build out a framework for developing a company's own ethical posture in the act of applying machine learning?
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of the use of the term operationalizing AI ethics. It's been, I think, a gap that's been kind of missing in a lot of the conversation that's been out there. There's, and you talked about some of the various perspectives and things that folks have done, and we've seen, you know, some of the things that I've seen that have gotten close to, you know, providing a framework are more kind of checklisty or manifesto-ish. You have all these different attempts, and they're all wonderful attempts, but I love that you're kind of, you know, pushing at a little bit more formalism without kind of diving into an academic treatise. So maybe can you walk us through the overall structure of this framework?
Yeah, for sure. So we actually used the steps that go into the process of building a machine learning system as the structure for our ethical framework. So basically we, you know, and there's variations on how a machine learning product might be built, but more or less companies follow the same process. So in the beginning, there's sort of a design phase where they have to ask, what problem are we actually solving? And I think one of the sort of pitfalls or the failure modes, let's say, in applied machine learning in the enterprise and times where enterprises sort of get stuck is they get caught up with the innovative potential of some cool new capability and forget to ask the question, what is the business value? What is our metric for success? And how do we measure baseline performance today and an improvement upon baseline to make a judgment call as to whether or not machine learning is really the right solution for our problem, right? And whether or not we want to invest in this technology in the first place. So we sort of start off with saying, giving some guidance and insight into how to go about framing and shaping a machine learning problem in the first place. Next, we talk about data collection. Where the data comes from, if it's coming from a product interface, how one can think about the design of that interface, both to collect usable data, data that will be easier to maintain the quality of in the long term, as well as if there's data that's coming from a third party where there might be provenance issues. We talk about then some of the data processing, depending on the different algorithmic technique a company is using. This could include sort of standard feature engineering or more some of the processing to prepare for a learning representation if one moves into the deep learning sort of side of things. We talk about how different types of algorithms can present different issues as it relates to fairness, bias, and transparency. And then we talk about putting the model into production, what it means to scale, how there's some issues that can arise from sort of overfitting on a training set to extending that out to larger data sets. And then we talk a lot about what I actually think is one of the most interesting and underrepresented portions of fairness in machine learning systems, which is maintenance, DevOps, and auditing of the system in the long run. So not just when we first build out that theoretical model, but how one can maintain accountability over a system over time. So that's sort of those are the steps that we think through. And obviously, you know, there's iterations there and there's feedback loops, and it's never quite as linear as it seems. But you know, that's sort of how we broke things down.
Monitoring and maintenance, I think, is underappreciated, not just from an ethics and fairness perspective, but from a machine learning perspective in general, right? There's a lot of focus in the industry on modeling and not quite enough on getting that model into production and the care and feeding that's required to make sure that the model is fresh and to protect the business.
Yeah, there's sort of a meta point to be made here where, you know, in this framework, we talk a lot about the interdisciplinary cross-functional questions. And this is sort of why it's framed more as a, we don't have the right answer. We can't reduce this down to a checklist where you just have to press, you know, press X button, press Y button. It's rather, this is the checklist of questions you need to ask. And the answer is going to depend upon the context. And therefore, it needs to be a collaboration between, you know, the legal team, the business team, the data team, the algorithms team, the engineering team. And that shows up at every point in the process. But if you think about this endpoint where it's around, you know, maintenance, operationalization of systems, et cetera, there too, there's some machine learning scientists who go so far as to build modular code and then put that out and scale it into production. But most of the time, this is going to then be collaboration with what Andrew Karpathy would call software 1.0 folks who, are working in a slightly different code stack and are representing and modifying the initial mathematics in the models to turn them into scalable, reliable software. So it's kind of all about the handoffs, the collaboration, and then finding a way to translate between two different language systems, two different modes of working to do the hard work of making these systems thrive in production.
On that point of translation, you also explicitly talk about some of the softer topics, people and communication. I don't know that you explicitly mentioned culture, but I imagine that plays a big role in this as well, a huge role. Can you talk a little bit about those topics?
Yeah, for sure. So let's break it down into two. So in thinking about culture, it's interesting. I recently heard DJ Patil give a talk at an ethics conference that Scotiabank hosted up here in Toronto. And he was mentioning that one of the key requirements for success to deploy AI ethically is to have a channel of resistance, right? To basically almost like a what are those things called where it's like the bat line, right? So it's like a channel where you're allowed to dissent, right? There's sort of like the accepted protocol, but people are empowered and they have the right to raise their hand and say, I don't think this is okay. So that's sort of, you know, I think there's a huge cultural implication there where teams are empowered to have a voice and to think critically about what they're building, and also to be stimulated and challenged to not just accept, you know, the base technical answer in building a machine learning model, namely that, you know, we've decided that our objective function is X, we're going to measure accuracy using, you know, sort of the following measures. And I guess like one of the idiosyncrasies or the uncomfortable paradoxes of, say, rendering a model fair is that often to make a model fair requires a little bit of a trade-off on its accuracy if one is just reporting on the performance of the model in its, you know, sort of in its normally functioning fashion. And it comes off as counterintuitive, right? Because like the scientists that are building the models are thinking about measuring their performance according to the set of constraints that they've learned in school and that they've been applying. And then to come into that and say, okay, we're going to actually design this so that there's a cut on accuracy. And then the question becomes, well, who makes that call? Do I make that call? Or does this need to be a cross-functional dialogue with like the business team? Did they make the call on some of the trade-offs that we're going to incur if we decide to make a model fair as opposed to sort of more accurate? And so, I think the translation questions are totally intertwined with the cultural questions, because there needs to be the foundation to enable these discussions to occur, to start to get traction in the first place. It's not just a, you know, let me download my fairness module from the cloud and the next thing you know, everything's gonna be fine. There's work to try to build out sort of open source scalable toolkits to address fairness, but we're still so early in the process, and there's still not even alignment across the technical community on what fairness means as a statistical problem. So we've got a lot of work to do to figure this out.
That makes me think of a couple of things. This notion of a channel of resistance calls to mind an article that I came across yesterday, maybe, you know, very contemporary, about how Google is experiencing, you know, internal turmoil is probably too strong, but there are very vocal kind of employee factions on two sides of the issue of the company's involvement in China. And that kind of suggests, in the context of this notion of a channel of resistance, that they have a very strong culture of, you know, supporting and allowing that kind of resistance, which kind of bodes well for their ability to, at least in this particular area, you know, support, you know, making ethical decisions around AI. Is that consistent with what you see?
That's a great question. I'm certainly not an expert in what's going on inside Google these days.
Sure, but I'm not either.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I think that it's interesting. My father, who worked in technology for 45 years, he was telling me that back in the 70s and 80s, when he was working, it wasn't even possible for two managers to be in a room together without a director present, right? So there was so much control over what might be gossip, what might be dissent, what might be back rumblings around what was going on in the company, that they didn't even, like, culturally, it was not possible for two people to meet, which I have trouble even imagining. You know, it's like, well, there's always water cooler discussions, right? Of course, there would be covert back channels, if not explicitly permissible back channels. But there's a difference there where, you know, it's like this as the organization coming together and explicitly sanctioning critical thinking, right? And explicitly empowering people from the technical side and as well as voices external to the company. So one of the things we talk about in the paper is that I think one of the failure modes in thinking about operationalizing ethics and let's say from an organizational perspective would be, let's appoint the ethics committee. Okay, well, who's on the ethics committee? And here we're thinking about large enterprises. So you can imagine it would be the chief data officer, the chief technology officer, somebody from the risk management department. And the question to be posed is, do the people who occupy those positions have the requisite diversity of opinion and perspective to function well as ethics officers? And often that's not the case, right? Because of the sort of, you know, the issues in diversity and inclusion in the workforce. And so we think it's really important not only that there's a channel of dissent, but also that multiple people's perspectives are brought to the table, in particular during the design phase. You know, you don't need to have sort of community representatives when it comes to thinking about audit logs and trails on productionalization of the systems. But in some of the early thinking on doing what we call a pre-mortem, where a team would not do a post-mortem where they've done their project and then they look backwards and say, okay, what worked, what didn't, what are we going to change? But rather taking the time to imagine prospectively some of the issues that might go wrong in applying a machine learning application, and taking that from the embodied perspective of people who are not like, you know, some of the, you know, not like you, right? Not like potentially the composition of an existing workforce. And so we ask and pose this in the paper, should there be customers on that ethics committee, or could it just be sort of different people's perspective within the organization? Another question is, going back to who makes the call and who's accountable, there's different opinions across the community as to whether or not there needs to be a neutral third party, almost auditing function, who comes in and basically has no skin in the game, and can therefore look through system design and audit it for compliance with some ethical standard. That makes sense to me, but I don't think it's enough, because as we say in the paper, if you sort of wait until the end and then go back through a system and see where it might have ethical pitfalls, there's a lot of wasted time. And there's so many in the moment pragmatic decisions that technical teams can make to save themselves the trouble of, say, implementing a neural network when the use case requires a level of interpretability and transparency given regulatory requirements. And they could have sort of just selected a different algorithm earlier on and avoided the subsequent requirement to redo work to meet regulatory or ethical requirements.
So maybe let's walk through some of the key questions that need to be asked at these different stages. Is that a good way to go through this, you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
So again, you kind of start with this notion of kind of problem definition and scoping. What needs to be thought about there? You just kind of talked about some of it. The way you define a problem is going to have direct implications on, I guess I'm kind of blurring the lines of problem definition with the whole neural network thing, but let me kind of roll that back and say, what are some of the questions that need to be considered when we're thinking about problem definition and scope?
Sure. So I'll talk about two that are partially just about all machine learning products and also have implications in ethics. So one is, how much error can the business tolerate in its predictions? And so as I think through this, it's a contextual question where, you know, you can imagine Amazon using a collaborative filtering algorithm to recommend products and personalize products to its customers. So there, you know, what's the worst case scenario if Amazon recommends that I buy a toilet as opposed to buying Tolstoy's War and Peace? It might be humorous. I might be like, well, this is funny. It could have implications. There's a couple of sort of horror stories where I believe somebody bought an urn for their after their grandfather died, and then subsequently they were sort of presented with all of these morbid death trinkets. So you know, obviously that can have some emotional impact on a user, but more or less, like, you know, a recommender in a commercial setting is one that can tolerate a relatively high level of prediction error, and therefore, you know, machine learning team doesn't need to work until they get to super high precision around accuracy, recall, et cetera. So just thinking contextually about that is does have both pragmatic implications as well as ethical implications. Areas where I've seen this gone wrong is in use cases where a business, like the end users, have a psychological perception that they need to have certainty from their system. So this is classic in, say, auditing. And I think we talked about this in the last podcast where, you know, if you're a Big Four consulting firm and your job is to audit 10K statements for your clients, you know, there's not a lot of error that can be tolerated in those predictions, because the whole name of the game is to assure, whatever that may be, at least from, you know, from our psychological perspectives, that yes, indeed, this 10K statement is in compliance with the general acceptable accounting principles, right? So so that's these fundamental questions in the output of machine learning algorithms, which aren't deterministic. They can vary over time, but that, you know, that this power broadens the applicability of what we can do with software systems today in such amazing ways, can have ethical impact if certain users of your population are not as well represented in a data set, and therefore the performance on the algorithm as it relates to the accuracy of predictions for products or services or whatever, you know, whatever for them is less sound than a population that's better represented. One of the other ones that I really like to think about actually was inspired by Jonathan Zunger in his super awesome article, Asking the Right Questions About AI, where he talks about how rigorous and precise we need to be in determining what our objective function actually optimizes for. So he gives the example, you know, the much cited example from the ProPublica recidivism prediction algorithms, where the impression that the end users of the system had, the judges, was that this system would tell them the likelihood that somebody would recommit a crime as a function of the sentence that was given to them. So if they're given a 5-year sentence, you know, low likelihood. If it's a 2-year sentence, they haven't been punished enough, and there's a high likelihood they're still gonna come back and recidivize. What he shows in that article that I think is so deftly done is that what the system actually measures is the likelihood of conviction, which is a very different problem, right? So it becomes clear to us that it's like, oh God, well, of course African Americans are going to have a higher likelihood based on, you know, past precedent. And so I see that all over the place in businesses too, where a business team might think, that they are optimizing for, let's say, long-term revenue from a credit card customer. When actually, if you look at how the algorithm's been designed, it's just plain old conversion. So they're not actually trying to get great customers. They're just trying to get more customers. And that has both business impact because, you know, you might be getting a lot of customers, but that might not actually lead to long-term revenue. And it has ethical impact because the customers that you end up converting might not actually be sort of like well served by the lines of credit that are given to them. And therefore, just being precise on sort of where we're, what our target variable is and what the implications are and optimizing for that has, again, both business considerations as well as ethical considerations.
That calls to mind a podcast that I did with Romer Rosales, who is director of AI at LinkedIn. And that one was called Problem Formulation for Machine Learning. And the example that they gave that was really interesting was, you know, some system that they had, a recommendation system or like something about groups, I think, that kind of optimized around engagement. And they, you know, their first versions of this system found that, hey, if we send more emails, people will be more engaged. But it didn't really capture kind of the quality of the engagement that they were looking for or the notion that they can piss people off by sending too many emails. And the big takeaway there that I found interesting was that while this problem formulation, even in your model, is kind of the first step, it's a very iterative process, right? You start someplace, you experiment, you learn, and then you can continue to evolve the way you define the problem and the nuance that you incorporate into that problem definition to kind of more closely zero in on what's really important.
I really love that you're saying that it's an iterative process, and it's absolutely right. So, you know, I mentioned earlier on these pre-mortems where we try to imagine what might go wrong, but the world is always much more complex than our measly imaginations can capture. And so it is really important that, you know, you go in with a certain amount of assumptions and then we learn. And we learn not only about the algorithm learning and improving its performance by, you know, updating its parameters, et cetera, but about our paying careful, critical attention to all of the assumptions, the sort of baked in assumptions that we weren't aware of until we put things out in the world. It's funny. Nick Bostrom has the famous anecdote about the paperclip maximizer in Superintelligence. Right. So if folks aren't familiar with that, it's basically, you know, we design this system that's optimized to create as many paperclips as possible or in the fastest amount of time. I can't remember exactly how it's formulated, but it leads to this, you know, the algorithm realizes iteration after iteration that humans are the blocker in paperclip production. So it's like, all right, let's exterminate the humans. And then we can just mine all the aluminum in the world to our heart's delight. And when I first read that, I was sort of like, oh God, like it pricked up my sensitivity around what I consider to be the sort of dangerous discussions around existential risk from AI. But the more I think about it, if you view it as a fable, it's a powerful fable because as you just described, optimizing for engagement, optimizing for some localizable, measurable, variable, observable variable can have drastic implications that we're not aware of. And what I like about the iteration is it needn't be that we succumb to the all-powerful paperclip maximizer if we are aware of the fact that there are risks in our reducing down the world to a quantitative, measurable, optimizable frame. But then keeping our lights, you know, our eyes open as we learn to know that this is indeed a reduction, to know that these systems are not super intelligent. You know, their correlation, gradient descent, search space optimizers, right? So that's it. And obviously there's incredible progress going on in the research community, but if we humble ourselves and humble our interpretation and actually realize how limited these systems can be, then it forces us to open our minds to think about the critical questions we need to ask from a values perspective as we and to empower ourselves operationally through these like this iterative learning to fix things. That's hard for consumer enterprises, in particular regulated enterprises, because they don't tolerate mistakes. The whole culture around risk management is around like absolute prevention of of a bad outcome, adherence to compliance standards, and that mindset, like a compliance mindset and a waterfall oriented legal risk management mindset, comes into a lot of tension and friction with a sort of iterative learning, let's fail, but then we'll rectify things, approach that is often required for machine learning.
Right, right. Yeah. And it also echoes very strongly back to the kind of the sixth step in your process, this monitoring and maintenance. If you're not monitoring the resource consumption of your paperclip maker and its secondary implications, you can't really effectively refine problem definition in the next iteration.
Yeah, my VP of engineering will be delighted to know that, I used to be really bored by things like logging, measurement. I was like, oh, God, this is the most boring stuff. I want to think about like algorithms and math. And now I'm endlessly fascinated. I have a lot of respect for the technical specifications and the rigor that goes into building an auditable system. I'll give you an example of one of the problems we've been thinking about. So in the wake of GDPR, we're working in Canada. And so there's still some questions related to how the privacy regulations might be updated in keeping with, what happened in the European Union and sort of discussions around the globe around the appropriate privacy frameworks. But the more progressive enterprises are acting as if GDPR were international and global. And so one of our customers was thinking about storing predictions. So, build out a machine learning model. It's in the marketing space. So it's recommending which action would be the next best action or offer for different customers. And, when that prediction is made, there's the data that went in to train the model, but then there's, the output of the model at a given moment in time. And so we were thinking, what if sometime in the future, right now we're November 29, 2018. What if on April 11th, 2019, a customer has a question about why they were served some particular offer, back 6 months ago? How would one resolve that if the model is indeed updating over time and if the output of a prediction in April is going to be different than it was in November? And so just keeping that log, right, not only thinking about logging data, not only thinking about sort of logging, anomalies in the system, but indeed logging this derived data that, GDPR would call a profile, or some sort of, some probabilistic output of a person's likelihood to act on something. It's just like there's a new data category that companies need to think about when they're, when they're logging things and they're thinking about auditing their systems.
So we should probably move through this list a little bit more quickly. Number two is design. Let's talk about that phase with regard to the questions that it should be prompting.
Yeah, so we were thinking about design here from a front end perspective. So it's a big term, but we were sort of narrowed it down to designing product interfaces. And the questions that we think about here are a lot around how you collect data, both so that you are reducing some of the ambiguities. If a question's hard for a person to ask, people are probably going to give answers that lead to low quality data, as well as some of the representational harm that the way in which data formats are presented could cause to people. So an example I like here is gender. So right now, I think Facebook has 73, and I could be off on the precise number, but I believe it's 73 different gender categories. When there's 73 different categories, that shows that the variable is continuous and not discrete, right? So if there are two or if there are five categories, and we can easily be like, I'm one of these five, it's probably discrete. But here it's this strange mapping of something that is it's hazy, right? It's continuous. And nonetheless, our systems, we need to put them into a tabular format. And that it leads to these interesting representational questions underneath the scenes. And then the third thing we think about in design is this a human in the loop system or is this a completely automated system? Because there's different legal and liability questions associated with either approach.
And so is there, as part of this, does the cross-functional aspect of this framework get represented in the design phase? Do you need to be, I guess I'm thinking of, and in fact, I think I remember reading in the paper, you kind of referring to agile ethics or agile, the word agile came up somewhere. And this in particular kind of calls to mind the whole do design with your customers from, traditional software development, agile applications?
Yeah. So I quoted the term agile ethics from Alex Dunn, who is the executive director of a company called The Engine Room based in the UK. I think she's fantastic. And I heard her, actually she had a blog post about the term agile ethics that came out during Access Now's RightsCon conference in Toronto in May. And I met her there and I was just like, oh my God, I love it. That's exactly what I'm thinking about. And so it's funny, I've used the term agile ethics at the bank. And the what this does not mean is that, like, you know, we can sort of update our principles on a day-to-day basis. So one day fairness means, you know, equality of opportunity. And the next day it's equity of outcome, right? That is not what I mean by agile ethics. What we mean is that, ethics need not be that one time final compliance review of a system. It should be embedded into the phases of an agile product development methodology. And then the second is, as it relates to design. So this is going to be the front end of the system. Consent is a big question here. So in thinking about, how are you going to represent a consent mechanism to your customer? Is it going to be, as we know, the sort of standard tacit, here's a 55 page legal document that nobody reads, but in order to play part in society and the system, you just sort of tacitly accept it? Or is there a way to represent it in a friendly, so not a, like, not sort of cumbersome way, but to make privacy a little bit more legible and meaningful to users now that we care about it? I think it's heartening to see that more and more people are seeming to care about it in the wake of, some of the privacy breaches that have occurred in over the past year.
So speaking of privacy breaches, data collection and retention. These are big issues here. And in fact, probably, this is maybe an area that's more obvious to people when they're thinking about responsible AI and ethics, or at least it, comes up frequently, right? Because from a privacy perspective. Is it broader than people tend to think?
I think if it is broader, it's that often problems that we associate to ethics in ML and algorithms actually start with data. And so, I think by now it's pretty well understood that it's garbage in, garbage out. So, if you've got a data set and you've got awesome representation of rich Caucasian males and very scant representation of not rich African American females, then the performance of your algorithm is going to vary across those represented sets. So I think what's tough is actually solving this in such a way where companies think about modifying how they are collecting data and how they're storing it, so as to sort of address this problem at its roots and its foundation. It's one thing to note that it's a problem. It's another thing to go through the changes required to, like, update your data collection and retention procedures. I think the other one is, from a risk management perspective and information governance, prior to ML, the sort of rule of thumb would be, if you don't need the data, delete it. Do you know what I mean? There's of course, staff.
Or you don't need a particular attribute as well.
You don't need an attribute. And if you don't, and think about email, like email retention. So like in the information governance community, there's going to be e-discovery and evidence and production requirements that mean that for a certain period of time, things need to be saved and stored in case there's some question, in case, in case files need to be reviewed. But once you're outside of that, it's just like, God, get rid of it. Obviously, it's cheaper to store massive data at scale now. So that's the sort of the economics of that have shifted a lot over the past 20 years. But from an ML perspective, this came up once in a discussion with a financial services firm that wanted to capture seasonal irregularities or seasonal regularities across multiple years in a particular domain. And if the retention folks, going back to cross-functional collaboration, say, delete after year three, and then the machine learning folks come in and they say, oh, no, but we don't want to overfit to, the recency. We want to actually have sort of a more historical view. There can be misaligned objectives, I'd say, in terms of, what to retain and what not to retain.
Yeah, I was just having a conversation with a manufacturer in the transportation industry, and they were talking about or we were talking about cultural implications and culture clashes kind of along these lines. And the same exact issue came up. They're collecting all of the sensor data about, you know, how their vehicles are being used, and their retention people are telling them to, you know, throw it away and, you know, to do things like kind of early anonymization. And they recognize that they don't really know what the potential future value of this data is and how they may want to use it. And they're kind of digging in, I guess, for lack of a better term, to kind of fight this long fight to try to shift this culture, or at least come to, you know, some happy medium. And I don't know that there's any formula for doing that.
You know, I recently became obsessed with an anecdote about Henry Ford, who, as a byproduct of his work creating cars, he set up a bunch of sawmills in Michigan, and he invested in the sawmills so that he could reduce this bottlenecks in his supply chain for wood, so that he could, you know, make steering wheels and baseboards, et cetera, for the cars a lot faster. And in doing so, he had all these stumps and branches and sawdust, like all this leftover wasted wood stuff. And so he ended up combining the wood with tar to create charcoal briquettes, and created a separate business line that has now become Kingsford Charcoal, which is still in existence today. I did not know that Henry Ford was the father of Kingsford Charcoal. And what I love about that story is I actually think it helps us sort of rewrite history in thinking about the legacy of Henry Ford for the data era, where we thought about, you know, the, like, Henry Ford is all about automation and the assembly line and reducing and squeezing out every ounce of variable cost from production systems to scale. But like, for the data era and the machine learning era, what's interesting about business processes is that they are unique vehicles to create data and knowledge about the world that only exists by as a byproduct of the activity of doing that work. And, you know, for me, that this is sort of the, how do you really, a lot of enterprises struggle with disruptive innovation in AI. It's kind of like, okay, we'll optimize something. Okay, we're going to automate an existing job. But like, is this it? Is this all we get here, is cost savings from AI? And it's like, not if you do this creative shift in the value of your business process and start to create a unique information asset. However, as you just said, doing that shifts around, you know, how we think about data and how we retain it. And when that data is created, you know, Henry Ford, the wood itself did not suggest charcoal briquettes. It was human ingenuity that combined tar with the wood to create a new business line. And similarly, it's like, all right, so where does human creativity lie in this whole AI equation? Well, the data itself is not worth much. It takes our designing, our framing, our applying the right algorithm, our lining up the right backend architecture to scale this to create value. And, you know, that's not an ethical point. That's more of a strategic point. But I think it's like the essence of innovation with AI.
When it comes to beyond the retention of the data, when it comes to processing the data, that also has huge ethical implications. Can you talk through some of the areas that you explore around processing?
I think the most salient point here has to do with a paradox of interpretability. So we tend to think that linear regressions are more interpretable and easier to control and govern than deep neural networks, because it's easier for us to align, you know, which input, which feature with which weight is correlated to which output, right? And we say, okay, we feel like we have control over that. That's interpretable. What I think is happening there, and it's a risk that we haven't really thought enough about, is that we're actually displacing the lack of transparency from the machine to the person's mind. So when a scientist and practitioner comes in and analyzes the data and decides, you know, which features to focus on, and when they're building out their model, there's lots of opportunity there for bias of some sort to inflect, you know, which features end up being featured. Sorry, a little bit of fun. Which features matter? Which features they select? Part of that will be from analytic observation. It will live within the data, but there's just so much room, for human bias to come in and be shaping the choices that are made in selection of features without our being aware of that. And so that's an overlooked aspect of data processing that makes us think a little bit more critically about this whole notion of sort of transparency and interpretability. And it's one where you have to sort of gut check yourself and be like, are we imposing our biases here? The other thing I talk about, and I think this could be a podcast on its own, has to do with some of the ways to think about data privacy in a machine learning first world, where we're sort of shifting from protecting a data point, so personally identifiable information in the form of my name, my address, my social security number, to obfuscating an individual within a distribution. So if you think about sort of, we've got 15 people in a room, how tall is everybody? What's the average height? It would be, the extent to which one individual is contributing to that mean and the standard deviation from the mean. And so this is the realm of sort of differential privacy and ways in which we can make it so that you can't reverse engineer an individual from sort of a large distribution. So there's a whole section in there on that. But again, I think it's a topic for another podcast.
And talking about the way we feature our features, you suggested that one of the dangers is imparting our biases into the models by the way we do feature engineering and the like. But it also prompted this question for me around, is there this other paradox that, there's this class of models that we think of as transparent, and so we don't question them as much, whereas there's this other class of models that we think of as opaque, and we spend a lot of energy trying to understand them. Is there a risk there?
I think so. I think it goes back to, it's almost like the Nick Bostrom point, where it's the risk of focusing a lot of our attention on the one area that's been sort of talked about, like that's been discursively accepted as like, this is where the risk lies. And people should be working on that. Like all of the work that's going into interpretability of neural networks is incredibly exciting and important work. I think there's a larger point that relates to even sort of the social stratus of, and the social like importance of different type classes of algorithms in the community. That doesn't mean that, linear regressions, logistic regressions, support vector machines don't have their ethical issues too. And it also doesn't mean that they're not worthy mathematical functions, for systems. At Fast Forward Labs, we always used to say, when you're applying ML, start with the simplest possible algorithm possible to solve your problem that can scale. And then once you've gotten baseline performance, then maybe experiment up with sort of some of the more complex models that can process hierarchical features and represent the data a little differently. But, don't start with the hammer when all that you need is sort of a chisel. I think there's a larger sociological point wrapped up in your question as it relates to the sort of hierarchy sometimes of like perceived value in the scientific and engineering community, and this shows up in the paper. In my experience, finding a lawyer, people talk a lot about the sort of scarcity of PhDs in machine learning. Finding a lawyer who knows a lot about the law and also knows a lot about how machine learning systems work so that they can pave new ground in thinking about how regulations should evolve or how compliance practices should evolve to encompass like the realities of new technical problems at a deep level and not just a sort of a conceptual level, mm-hmm. Those people are really hard to find. Wow. And I feel like they're heroes whose song needs to be sung a little more,
So in the next step in your framework, which looks at model prototyping and QA testing, does this go beyond the model evaluation, the statistical aspects of modeling, or is that the focus?
A lot of it is around the statistics. So Q&A, is this basically test and control, having your test set, having your validation set, seeing how the model performs. And I think the particular ethical aspect of it has to do with subsampling areas of the model. So not just doing sort of holistic, how is this performing, but rather, are there pockets of a population where the model seems to be performing well for the majority group, but if you look at the minority, the performance is opposite. So this is often referred to as Simpson's paradox. So it's sort of a particular fine-grained comb on Q&A with an eye towards potential fairness and bias pitfalls. And then some of the other, one of the other things we bring up in the Q&A testing are inspired by some of the work that Ian Goodfellow, who I know has been on the podcast, has done as it relates to basically tricking a model, a malicious actor tricking a model into metaphorical term, into a QA tester's vantage point, seeming to perform well according to the standards that we're measuring the model's performance by, when actually it's been tricked into doing a misclassification or doing something, or having the wrong output.
Your first point makes me think of kind of ethical unit tests for models. Have you come across a scalable framework for doing that, or does it not require anything special?
I personally haven't seen it, but I wouldn't be surprised if someone's working on that. And I like the term. You should like that.
I know we're running out of time, but the sixth step in the framework is deployment, monitoring, and maintenance. We've talked about it a little bit already. Anything you want to add there?
I'd say we've talked about it a lot. I'd advise folks to have a look at the paper if they're interested in it. And then I guess the one thing has to do with documentation. So not just sort of the auditing and logging controls in the system itself, as well as all the proper DevOps on the tool, but also the hard work of documenting what choices were made, when, why. And there's questions around whether or not that's a sort of internal technical compliance tool, internal sort of cross-functional compliance tool, or also could be something that is presented then to end users so that they, friendly language, so that if they have questions around the transparency of a system, there's communication on how frequently the model is updated, if it's possible to remove, if somebody decides to opt out of a system, what the retraining cycles for the models entail, and sort of a guarantee. There's a section in the paper where we say, well, what if you were to get a confirmation if you opt out of some data collection mechanism and a machine learning algorithm associated with it? That's like, model's been retrained, you're removed. You're no longer part of this, you've been forgotten by the system. That might be overly cumbersome, but it's something we propose as food for thought.
We've talked quite a bit about the paper. Is it easy for folks to find? I just pulled up the integrate.ai site and it didn't jump out at me. Maybe we can set up a place where people can kind of easily go to grab it.
Yeah, you bet. If you go on the integrate AI site, there's a tool, like a button or whatever, called Trust. And it's under that Trust button, and there's a page for Responsible AI. But we can definitely find a way to make it a little bit easier to find. There's a website that's devoted to it in particular, or a subpage on our website. But it's accessible through the Integrate AI website under the Trust tab.
Okay, got it. I see it. Easy enough. Any kind of final thoughts or words of wisdom?
Yeah, I'd say just to sum things up, there's so much attention paid to ethics these days. I think it's wonderful that we're having these large discussions around AI in society, and that this technology is encouraging us to question our values so holistically. However, as we started off, there's still so much work to do in taking this from sort of the philosophy, the domain of philosophy, and the domain of fun conversations at dinner parties into practical operational decisions. And what we were trying to do here is to show that often ethics occurs in the trenches, right? It's like, it's the decisions that teams make when they're building systems. They're hard to make, and they require accountability and decision rights. And it's within that tension that we think that we can really do some work to change things. So the call to action is to not only talk about these issues, but to think really critically about how to put them into practice.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much. Always wonderful to speak with you. We need to find a way to do it more often. Thanks for being on the show.
Totally concur. It's great to talk to you, Sam.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on Catherine or any of the topics covered in this episode, visit twimmelai.com/talk/210. Thanks once again to the great folks over at Georgian Partners for their sponsorship of this series. Be sure to head over to twimmelai.com/Georgian for more information on their Building Conversational AI Teams guidebook. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.